to Northfolk Works, and I'm Hazel Kahn. I'm very pleased today to welcome Stony Brook University scientist, Christopher Gobler. So welcome, Professor Gobler.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
I'd also like to introduce you in full. You hold the Endowed Chair of Coastal Ecology and Conservation at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University. Your research focuses on global coastal change. What else should we know before you tell us what is in your annual State of the Bays lecture last month?
Well, I mean, I can just say that I'm a professor at Stony Brook University. I've been a professor there for more than 15 years. I've been a professor on Long Island for more than 20 years. I've been doing research on Long Island's coastal waters for 30 years, starting this next month. Got into studying local waters because the problems that I saw back in the 80s.
So the State of the Bay lecture, which has been my framework for contacting you, is that something you've been doing for many, many years, or is that a relatively new thing, the State of the Bay's lecture?
I've been doing some form of that for close to 20 years, actually. It's evolved, and I think I only started calling it the State of the Bay's address or symposium in the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Then begin by telling our listeners, what are the main findings of the problems that you emphasized in your talk? And I'm going to reassure our listeners that you'll be explaining things like what nitrogen is and where nitrogen comes from and why it's so bad for our waters and what are things like algae and algal blooms. If you could also point out, sometimes it's not clear to me what the consequence or the outcomes of something are rather than their causes. I know causation is a complicated thing, but wherever possible, if you could sort of show the sequence of things, would be very, very helpful for our listeners. The mic is over to you now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. One way to contextualize what I presented in the State of the Bays for this year is to maybe give a longer term framework to what we've been witnessing over the last 30 or 40 years. What we've seen is that the levels of nitrogen in the groundwater that is our drinking water source, but also that drains into surface waters, those concentrations of nitrogen have risen, but essentially now to a level of most recent average approaching 4 milligrams per liter, which is very high compared to what's in surface waters. And we know that when that nitrogen hits surface waters, it can exact an effect on both marine habitats as well as what's happening in the water. On the habitat front, salt marshes degrade when they're overloaded with nitrogen because their roots get weaker. So that's a simple one. Mm-hmm. But then there's also a cascading effect once the nitrogen is released into the water that can stimulate algal blooms. Algae are small single-celled plants that can proliferate very quickly. In some cases, those algal blooms are what we call harmful algal blooms because they may make a toxin that can be poisonous to humans or animals, or they may be harmful to marine life. And then further, as those blooms proliferate, the water can become more turbid. That turbid water reduces the distribution of seagrass beds in our bays, which are a vital habitat for fish and shellfish. And then there's the direct effect of the harmful algal blooms. They can be toxic directly to fish and or shellfish. And then we also know that when those blooms decay, they can lead to conditions of either low oxygen, but also low pH. And we know that also can be harmful to marine life. So it's a whole sequencing of events. And, just to highlight, tying this now to the State of the Bays, in that presentation, and as I do every year, I sort of give the highlights of, how things are changing and what's new. And so, in 2021, for example, we identified more than 24 locations across Long Island, including Long Island Sound and Connecticut waters, that were be considered what we call dead zones. That is, the oxygen is below 3 milligrams per liter, and that obviously can be harmful to marine life. We identified nearly 24 lakes and ponds on Long Island that had high levels of toxic blue-green algae, and that can be a threat to human health as well as the health of pets. We also identified, at this point now, 8 different total harmful algal blooms, including 2 new types of harmful algal blooms in marine waters, one caused by a microalgae and another caused by a seaweed. And one of these new harmful algal blooms, the one caused by the seaweed, is invasive. It came originally from Asia and is a potential both human and marine animal threat. Maybe I'll pause there.
This new algal bloom that may have come from Asia, it's something Japonica, right?
That's right. The species is Japonica. The genus name is called Daisy Siphona. Japonica is because it's native to Japan. At the end of the 20th century, it spread through Europe. And actually, only in the last 15 years or so, it's been spreading in the Northeast U.S. We identified it, published a paper on its invasion and spread through Long Island. The paper came out in 2021. And we have a paper pending that shows that when blooms of these seaweeds decay, they leave this red tinge in the water. They release a compound called chilaerpin that's a toxin, or that red water that's released from the decaying seaweed can be lethal to juvenile fish and shellfish.
And not all algal blooms come from seaweed, right?
That's right. So right now we document the annual occurrence of 8 different types of harmful algal blooms on Long Island. 2 are from seaweeds, and then 6 are from microalgae. It was at the end of the 20th century that scientists came up with this sort of all-encompassing term, harmful algal bloom, as simply a definition to say when they grow to a point where they have a negative ecosystem consequence, we just call those harmful algal blooms. Hmm. Both types fit in that umbrella.
But before they became harmful, they were benign?
The harm has to be documented. And so probably the ill effects of some of these were what we would maybe call cryptic. You know, it was happening, but people didn't know. But the interesting thing actually on Long Island, that I just told you, there's 8 different types of harmful algal blooms. But if you went back in time to 1960 through 1984, there was no documentation of harmful algal blooms. So the onset of this diversity of harmful algal blooms and their annual occurrence is a new phenomenon. One of the things I showed in my State of the Bays is that fact. First, we had brown tides show up as the first new harmful algal bloom in 1985. And then we had other types that make toxins that showed up more recently. And then the seaweeds, and then, you know, other types that we call ecosystem disruptive. So, you know, we really went from none to 8 annually just in the last 35 years or so. The other interesting thing is that in that period from 1960 to 1985, Long Island had the largest hard clam fishery in the United States and one of the largest bay scallop fisheries in the United States, and both collapsed by more than 99% with the onset of these harmful algal blooms and direct linkages to them. Nitrogen is probably the strongest cause for these. In some cases, there's also a temperature link. As an example, something we call the rust tide that occurs in summer, we know it's promoted by nitrogen, we've shown that. But we've also seen that our waters have warmed significantly since the 1980s, and this rust tide occurs during the peak of the summer. Well, back in the 20th century, our waters never got to the absolute peak that this rust tide would need to form blooms. It was too cool. But since 1980, we're now 3 degrees warmer than we were in summer. And I should emphasize that climate change is not universal with regards to time or space. So, you know, I always say to people, if you want to find places that are cooling on the planet, I can show them to you. If you want to find places that are warming at above average, well, you can look at, for example, Long Island Sound during summer, you know, not during spring. If you went back to the 20th century, our waters didn't stay warm enough long enough for this rust tide to form a bloom. But now we have almost a 2-month window of sort of the ideal temperatures. And so with that, plus the additional nitrogen, it's got a pretty wide window now forming harmful algal blooms. And I just to close the loop on the Daisy Siphona japonica, the red seaweed that's harmful to marine life. In the paper we published in 2021 in the journal Biological Invasions, we showed that it's stimulated by both excessive nitrogen, but also high levels of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas that's increasing in our atmosphere, but also in our surface waters. And so Long Island was more vulnerable to invasion by this seaweed because we have high levels of nitrogen and we can have seasonally high levels of carbon dioxide, both from the atmosphere but also from excessive levels of nitrogen, and that becomes more complicated to explain. But
could you just explain a little bit more, though, about nitrogen, why this is one of the main causes of what's going on?
Yeah. So traditionally, it's assumed that the nitrogen is the limiting element for what we call permanent producers, algae, and marine ecosystems. And through the decades, we've certainly tested that dozens and dozens of times on Long Island, and that is almost always the case, particularly during summer. And so what that ends up meaning is that the more nitrogen that goes into the water, the faster that these algae can grow, the more rapidly they can accumulate. And typically, the ill effects are proportional to the amount of nitrogen. And there have been, on Long Island, but also in Connecticut, assessments of where does the nitrogen come from. And the answer is almost always that wastewater is the largest source of nitrogen. And in Suffolk County, most of that wastewater comes from what we call on-site septic systems. So that is 70% of Suffolk County is not sewered, not connected to sewage treatment plants. And instead, homes have literally holes in the ground where the wastewater goes and drains into the groundwater. And then that wastewater is very rich in nitrogen. And then that further then will drain into the aquifer and the drinking water source for Long Island. And what's not extracted for drinking water then drains into surface waters. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've got that excess nitrogen, it's going to be taken up by the algae. When there's more nitrogen released, they're going to grow more. For the microalgae, these cells just simply divide. So 2 becomes 4, becomes 8, becomes 16, et cetera, et cetera. They can grow very quickly. They can replace themselves or double every single day. So you can, you know, very quickly end up with what we call an algal bloom. The ill effects that these harmful algal blooms can have on a coastal ecosystem, the ill effects are often dose dependent, as we would call it. So more nitrogen gives you more algae, and then more algae depending on what the species and type of the different 8 that we've called out, you know, will have a greater likelihood of a negative effect on either human health or marine organisms or marine ecosystems or marine habitats.
And is all nitrogen equal? Is that just a concentration thing, or are there actual different compositions that nitrogen can be? I mean,
you know, there are some other forms. It can be converted and cycled a little bit in surface waters. But in general, there is the what we call the dose-dependent effect. So the more that goes in, the more algae you get, and the greater the likelihood of negative ecosystem consequences.
I'm trying to understand the relationship between nitrogen in the waters and algal blooms and climate change. Are they causally related?
The nitrogen is what's used by the algae to grow. But of course, we have to, in parallel, consider climate change processes. And climate change is happening because there's more carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. When that carbon dioxide gets into our oceans, it causes, or our coastal waters even, it causes ocean acidification. And yet another symptom of climate change is actually low oxygen. Warmer waters hold less oxygen and are often less ventilated, not exchanging with the atmosphere as well, particularly in deeper water. So we've got the four horsemen of the ocean climate change apocalypse. Yeah. And the four horsemen being warming, acidification, low oxygen, and harmful algal blooms. And the point I make about these four horsemen, more scientific term, we can call them ocean stressors or just stressors in general, because they each can be stressful for marine organisms. You know, they're all co-occurring at the same time. And so the nitrogen is on the one hand promoting the algal blooms. The climate change, on the other hand, is promoting the hypoxia, the warming, and the acidification. But the nitrogen can also exacerbate the acidification and the hypoxia. We're getting into some complexities here, but all these things are happening all at once.
Right.
The warming, the acidification, the low oxygen, and the harmful algal blooms.
Yeah, these are cumulative effects.
That's right. You know, as a scientist, I worry about is the amount of information that we have on the cumulative effects of these stressors is very limited. Frankly, it's a new field of research.
Marine scientist Chris Gobler is talking about the state of Long Island's bays. This is North Fork Works on WPKN Radio.
We know for a fact that our coastal waters are going to get warmer. We know that leads to lower oxygen. We know as CO2 accumulates, the pH will go down. And we know harmful algal blooms aren't going away. But what we don't know is how that the marine life is necessarily going to respond to all those things.
But what are some of the effects on marine life, thinking about fish and oysters that are there more likely to be poisoned or toxic?
Yeah, that's a generally fair assessment. Fish can swim and therefore will often leave the locations when these conditions emerge. And we've seen that time and again. The particular zones that are vulnerable to these conditions generally don't host robust shellfish populations. On Long Island, over the last 15 years, we've had more than 7 different locations experience more than a dozen shellfish bed closures because of the high levels of toxins in shellfish.
Are those permanent closures?
No, those thankfully are seasonal. Typically what happens, the bloom comes up, shellfish will accumulate the toxins. The particular algae that forms these blooms actually doesn't like it when it gets to peak summer temperatures. And so it's usually a spring phenomenon. They're seasonal and usually isolated to the spring.
Can you talk about other things that can be done?
What can be done is to make the environment less hospitable for these events. Of course, the nitrogen's a prime driver. And the biggest source of nitrogen for Long Island is wastewater. In Suffolk County, 70% of homes discharge their wastewater into the groundwater. Therefore, upgrading septic systems to the types that are now permissible and being frequently installed in Long Island are these low nitrogen systems. They're called innovative and alternative on-site septic systems. They reduce nitrogen by at least 60%, in some cases up to 80 or 90%. And there are grants available in Suffolk County and from New York State to install these for very little cost, in some cases no cost, particularly if you live on the South Fork. Website Suffolk County runs, it's called reclaimourwaters.info, and that's where you can get all the information on upgrading septic systems. So that's probably one of the most important things that can be done. You know, as a marine scientist, I'm very interested in all of the what we call in-the-water solutions for mitigating both algal blooms and in some cases, some climate change effects. So we've done a lot of work in the last decade plus in using both bivalves and also seaweeds to help improve water quality and mitigate nitrogen loading.
They become filters, the bivalves and the seagrass.
That's right. The bivalves are known as filter feeders. And so, for example, in Shinnecock Bay, I lead a program called the Shinnecock Bay Restoration Program, where we've planted more than 4.5 million hard clams. And we've seen stupendous results with regards to the repopulation of that bay with bivalves and the mitigation of harmful algal blooms, and even more harvest for baymen, because we're planting the clams in areas that are close to shellfishing. So it's really those clams are able to reproduce and repopulate the bay. So that's been a very successful program, and we're currently working with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation on something called the Long Island Shellfish Restoration Program. We're seeking to replicate what was done in Shinnecock Bay in other locations across Long Island. And in the wintertime, we've been growing something called sugar kelp, and we've grown that on 10 oyster farms across New York State, from Fishers Island to the Bronx. And we've been growing other seaweeds during the summer, because every seaweed has its season. But we've seen great results with these seaweeds in that they can deter harmful algal blooms and can even combat ocean acidification. We just published a paper that came out last week on this that shows that the seaweeds, particularly sugar kelp, can absorb CO2 and have sort of this halo effect on an oyster farm to make the conditions more optimal growth patterns for the oysters.
You were quoted also as saying, but we're not going to solve our nitrogen problem with seaweeds.
I did say that. You know, the root cause are these on-site septic systems. You know, we can do some very, what I would localized mop-up work, farming the seaweeds on oyster farms where you've got shellfish that are vulnerable to both harmful algal blooms and ocean acidification. But we're not going to combat global ocean acidification with seaweed, and we can't fend off harmful algal blooms in an entire estuary with seaweeds, but it's looking like we can have localized effects to benefit oyster farms?
Well, it's the old problem, isn't it? Is where do you look for the solution? By preventing the nitrogen from entering the bays in the first place, it's like starting upstream to prevent the problem downstream.
Precisely.
You prevent it than having exactly to mop it up.
Yeah. I would just comment on that. Yes, you have to and you must address the source. But one important nuance here is that the groundwater that's receiving the wastewater currently can take decades to travel from land out to surface waters. And therefore, while we're on the one hand upgrading septic systems across Long Island and in Suffolk County, we need to, in parallel, to address these in-the-water solutions, because it's going to take time in some instances for the nitrogen that's already in the groundwater to sort of flush its way out and work its way out into the ecosystem.
So it's a very dynamic situation. That's why we need all the solutions to accumulate together.
Correct.
But one of the things you haven't mentioned, and I'm as somebody who lives here on the North Fork and in Suffolk County, I know that when one talks about these new septic systems, everybody throws up their hands and say, yeah, $30,000, or it's taxed as income and all those things. Can you bring us up to speed in what the legislative end of all of that is?
Sure. A lot of this is more in the governmental realm.
Right.
I can say that they are seeking to resolve the tax issue. My understanding is that there is legal precedent to have that overturn, and that is in progress, and there's it's expected that will no longer be the case in short order. And then the other thing is that it's a whole new business ecosystem here on Long Island in Suffolk County for installing these systems. This is going to be a tremendous effort. Suffolk County plans on upgrading 200,000 septic systems in the next 30 years. And if you do the math on that, that's a multi-billion dollar industry. So yes, right now, some of these installs are quite expensive. But I do think that there's opportunities for the cost of these systems to come down in the future with more competition. I have to mention that of the many hats that I wear, one of them is director of the New York State Center for Clean Water Technology at Stony Brook University. And so we have developed a on-site septic system called the Nitrogen Removing Biofilter. And it's in the final months of piloting in Suffolk County. We expect these to be approved for widespread installation by the end of this year. They're comprised simply of sand and wood chips. All they have beyond that is a single dosing pump. That's the only moving part. And I should say they're performing incredibly well. They, on the nitrogen front, they're as good as any commercial system. And they also remove all sorts of contaminants that you don't get removal of for other systems. Things like 1,4-dioxane and pharmaceuticals and drugs. And because of the simplicity of their design, we're optimistic that this could be one of the technologies that drives prices down. Essentially can be used in place of the giant leaching rings that people have.
I see.
Those can get removed, and this instead, the water can flow to one of these nitrogen-removing biofilter drain fields. We've installed more than two dozen of these across Suffolk County, and they're performing well. And there's a approval process that Suffolk County has, and we're optimistic that final approval by the end of the year, that there'll be widespread implementation.
I've not heard of that. You also have mentioned the world's first water quality app.
Yeah, we developed a water quality app last summer. It's a phone app that's GPS-based, so just like a mapping app, it shows where you are, but it also shows all the surface waters around you, and it has information on beaches, whether they're open or closed, based on county and state health declarations, and it's updated several times a day. Also has information on over 500,000 acres of New York shellfish grounds, telling you if the water body you're in is open or closed to shellfishing. And then also has data that comes out of my lab. Starting in May, we start monitoring dozens of locations across Long Island, and that data goes up on the app as well. So you can see what the conditions are with regards to things like oxygen and water clarity and things like that. So we had our first launch last summer. I know some school groups, for example, use the app in classrooms across Long Island this school year, but we're going to have a more streamlined and even more user-friendly version that should be released by Memorial Day. That's right.
I have a couple of more questions. All the humans that live on the land, how are they affected by what's going on in the water? I know you mentioned that there's higher rates of bladder cancer, for example, on Long Island. Can you talk about the effects on human health?
I can talk about that in two ways. There are an increasing number of epidemiological studies that essentially are finding statistically significant links between higher levels of nitrate in drinking water and the incidences of different cancers, including bladder, kidney, gastric, colon, and even ovary cancers. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of emerging research. So right now, the regulations on nitrate levels in drinking water are set at 10 milligrams per liter. This research is finding epidemiological evidence at significantly lower levels of nitrogen, sometimes 2 milligrams per liter, 3, 4, 5. Of course, regulations take a long time to take effect. You know, with this evidence, at the very least, we want to have nitrogen levels or nitrate levels in our drinking water as low as possible. So that's the one thing I would say. The other human health aspect here is that many of these harmful algal blooms, they can make shellfish toxic, and so that can make people sick. We, even in our fresh waters, we have blue-green algae blooms, or also sometimes called cyanobacterial blooms, that make toxins. Well, maybe a final thing I'll just mention is that in Florida, people probably most commonly affected by those red tides because the toxins they make are aerosolized. So people go to the beach, there's a wind coming on shore, and they end up inhaling these toxins and getting sick. And this has been very well documented by the CDC and other federal scientists. We know less about how that happens or the propensity for that to happen for other types of harmful algal blooms, but we don't think it's a big issue for the marine harmful algal blooms, but for these freshwater ones that can get very dense, it's a possibility and also one that we're looking into more carefully.
Stony Brook University scientist, Christopher Gobler, thank you very much for doing this and for telling our listeners stuff that they really need to know. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they want more information about what your work is, about what you're doing?
Sure. Well, my lab's website can be found at Stony Brook University. If you put in Stony Brook University and Gobler Lab, you'll find the lab website, which has links to all of our publications. I make an effort to try to make everything we publish free for the public. And we publish, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20 papers a year. And that gives you a sense of what we're up to. On that same website, you can find links to all of our social media feeds. So we have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and a YouTube channel that also gives updates through the season, little tidbits as to what we're all up to and finding as we move through our research. So those are probably two of the best ways to keep in touch.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I'm really happy we were able to do this. And
yeah, it was great. And thank you for your thoughtful questions, and happy to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay,
bye-bye then.
Bye.
You've been listening to marine scientist Chris Gobler talking about the state of Long Island's bays. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of the month at this time and at any other time you choose as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. Thank you for listening to this program and to WPKN. I'm Hazel Kahn.